From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. Culinary historian Michael Twitty comes to Southern food and cooking with eyes wide open. Colonel Sanders may be the global symbol, but it's African Americans who brought it, made it, scraped by for it. Michael Twitty called out Paula Deen for backseating that history. Now he's telling it himself. This hour on Point, Black culinary historian Michael Twitty is talking slavery and Southern food. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What's the history we need to taste in Southern food? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Richmond, Virginia is Michael W. Twitty. He's author of the new book, just out today, The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. You can find an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. On our website, you can also find his recipes for brined chicken roasted in cabbage leaves and cowhorn okra soup. Michael is a culinary and cultural historian. He launched the Southern Discomfort Tour, in which he traveled to and cooked in southern locations that were central to slavery and his own family's history. His experiences are documented in the book. Michael Twitty, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
And wonderful. It's really great to have you here. This is food that I know and love from family and childhood, and it's really interesting to read your take on it. What are you up to here? What's your project, Michael?
So I guess there's several different strains. The most important one for me is a lifelong goal of being the first, I guess, I don't know what you call him, master chef from the antebellum era to have lived in the past 150 years. I mean, colonial antebellum cooking through the lens of an African-American cook was once the height of America's historic cuisine. To have the black chef there with their talents, being able to mold and meld all these cultures together in one pot. And I started, you know, by fumbling and making mistakes, which is really important to learning anything. Mm-hmm. And then I just got into this idea that I wanted to revive this tradition, just the same as anyone, you know, revives any other craft.
You look at the history, you look at the personal history here, and we'll come to that. You live the history. I mean, you not only cook, but you kind of reenact, even at Colonial Williamsburg and other historic locations, you reenact what the setting would have been, what the cookways would have been of African-American cooks, as you say, antebellum, before the Civil War.
Yep. And I would rather say interpret. Mm-hmm. I don't reenact
okay.
slavery.
Okay. Oh, well, yes, yes, thank you. Yes. Duly noted, so and we're glad for that.
Okay, great.
How do you do it? Give us a sense. Put us there. When you
so,
put it
you know,
on.
When you, mm-hmm. Yeah, when you walk into these kitchens, the first thing you got to do is worry about wood. And I talk about that in the book, and I won't rehash that. But, you know, it's the wood. It's the pots. It's making sure everything's clean and right and good. And
oh, you can rehash anything right here. We want to hear it. Not everybody's read this book. I hope they will.
Oh, that's but. Well, I want them to go out and read it.
they will.
But there's the act of you know, making mm-hmm. kindling mm-hmm. and chopping the wood. Mm-hmm. And actually having a conversation with the utensils that you use as if they're your friends, as if they're your allies in the act of making the food, which is extremely Southern, extremely African. Mm. And then there is the, you know, assembling all the raw ingredients. And for me, you know, going to the gardens and getting the produce right now in African Virginian heirloom garden at Colonial Williamsburg, mm-hmm. where I get a lot of my, but not all of my produce for my demonstrations. And people are really amazed to see the colors, the variety, how much a little plot can grow. And just the act of, you know, getting the smells in the kitchen started, whether it's frying meat or sauteing onions or whatever the act may be. People are astounded this time of year. You know, having 100-degree temperatures outside, mm-hmm. and you walk into this little wooden kitchen, and it's blazing hot. And you have to explain to people, I have the choice to go home at the end of the day. My ancestors did not. And that really puts in perspective things. But also, Tom, it goes to the point that I use food to talk about slavery and race because they are a valuable and valid way of easing those brick walls that otherwise prevent people from talking.
And you make it plain that there's been a kind of appropriation or misinterpretation, very often widespread. You write in the book, The Cooking Gene, you say the Old South is a place where people use food to tell themselves who they are, to tell others who they are, and to tell stories about where they've been. You're putting your own take on it. Could you read a little bit right from the first chapter here, right from the preface, Michael?
Sure.
About the Old South and the people, the many strands there.
Right. And I want to preface this preface sample by saying that I'm taking back that term, the Old South, because it's been used as a weapon. We built it, but it's used as a weapon against us. So this kind of taking that terminology back. So let me go ahead and read that. The Old South is where people are far more likely to be related to one another than not. It is where everybody has a Cherokee lurking in their maternal bloodlines, but nobody knows where the broad noses or big asses come from. It is a place where dark gums and curly hair get chalked up to lost Turks and meandering mystics, but Nigeria and Gambia are long forgotten, unlike anything else that perpetually and remittingly remembered. Proud bloodlines of Normandy and Westphalia, County Armagh and Kent, endure here, and like it or not, it is often in bodies that bear no resemblance to those in whom those genes first arrived. Black bodies like mine. The Old South is a forgotten little Africa, but nobody speaks of it that way. Everything black folks gave to the aristocracy and plain folks becomes spun gold in the hands of others, from banjos to barbecue to Elvis to rice and cotton know-how. Everything we black Southerners kept for ourselves, often the unwanted dregs and markers of resistance, felt like markers of backwardness, scratches of the uncivilized, idolatry, and the state of being lost. And yet I loved that Old South and loved it fiercely in all her funkiness and dread. To be honest, I never hated white people for their strange relationship to us, their colored kith and kin. But I grew up with the suspicion that they had no clue just how much of us there was in them and their family trees and their stories and bloodlines and on their groaning tables. Maybe if they did, we would know less enmity towards one another. The Old South is where I had to return.
Michael Twitty, reading from his new book, The Cooking Gene, and return he did, big time. Would you explain for us, you say that the Old South is a forgotten little Africa, but nobody speaks of it that way. What do you mean exactly? It's hardly as though the history of Africans and African Americans in the Old South is not visible, is not palpable.
Oh, well, you know what? That depends on your perspective.
Okay.
You see, we started by, if you look at the iconic elements, films, even paintings. One of my great friends and mentors, John Michael Vlatch, wrote a book called The Planter's Prospect, where he talks about paintings of plantations. You know who's missing from a lot of those historic paintings? Black people.
Yeah, okay.
You know who's missing from the recreation of those paintings for the sake of colonial revival? Black people. Well, the first time I went to Alabama to do genealogical research with my uncle, I remember going to one of the courthouses, and they had an incredible mural. It was top to bottom. And on that mural at the bottom were the Cherokee, the Creek, the Choctaw, and the Chickasaw, were the four of the five so-called civilized tribes that lived in Alabama. And then there's no people of African descent. It's just white businessmen and planters as if we never existed. Our graves are plowed over to make condos and golf clubs and gas stations. It's as if we never existed. So, you know, we're gentrified. we're expelled by hurricanes and nobody wants to get us back. It's as if we never existed. So I don't think we can take for granted the idea that everybody knows. In fact, at Colonial Williamsburg, I was just interpreting there and going back there this afternoon, there was a woman from Savannah, Georgia, a white lady with the twang. She had the accent. She had no clue that Hop and John, okra soup, red rice, things that she'd always lived with.
Sure.
She looked astounded at me and said the words, "Those come from Africa? I never knew that. I never had any clue." So we can't assume that sort of past and culture and history is obvious to everyone, or that they know the import of it.
But the food tells the story to you unmistakably.
Oh, Yes, the food is where the DNA lies, because the food is one of the few places where we were able to exercise the muscle of African civilization in plain view.
And you're talking here not just about cooking traditions, but about foods themselves that came over and back and over again. Okra and black-eyed peas and kidney and lima beans and scotch bonnet peppers and peanuts and millet and sorghum and watermelon and yams and sesame, on and on. The very stuff of the cuisine, what's on the table.
Right. And that what's on the table tells you a lot about the people who are eating it and the negotiations they've made to become American.
Michael W. Twitty has journeyed deeply into what he – in his version of the Old South, and we'll look at how he defines that. It's wide-ranging. He's looked at the food. He's looked at his own family history. He's looked at the nation's history, the deep links to Africa embedded in the cuisine of the South. His new book that tells the story is The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South, just out today. Behind us right here, No More Auction Block by Ella Jenkins. And you know what that means. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back.
No more auction block for me. No more, no more. No more auction block for me. Many thousand gone. Many thousand gone. No more. Pick a cone for me. No more, no more. No more. Pick a cone for me. Many thousand gone. Many thousand gone.
Support for this podcast and the following message comes from ZipRecruiter, who understands when you run a business, you've got important decisions to make every day, like hiring. ZipRecruiter makes finding quality candidates simple. With one click at ZipRecruiter.com/OP, you can post your job to 100 leading job sites across the web and manage your candidates all in one place with ZipRecruiter's easy-to-use dashboard. Find out today why ZipRecruiter has been used by businesses of all sizes to hire. Try ZipRecruiter for free at ZipRecruiter.com/OP.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the food of the American South and the story it tells, the slave story especially, the hard story, the soulful story, with culinary and cultural historian Michael W. Twitty. He went on what he called a discomfort tour through the South, took him through the history of the cuisine there, through family history, did a lot of genealogical research. We'll look at that. He recreates or reinterprets the cooking of the antebellum South, and he's written about the whole experience in a big new book, The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. Joins us today from Richmond, Virginia. You can join us this hour. What do you hear in the story of Michael Twitty's journey, his discomfort tour? And could two people, white and black, sit, eat the same plate of Southern food and have very different associations? Or does this food, this cuisine, to your mind, pull people together, whatever their race and background? And Michael, lots of people calling for you already from Hilton Head Island in South Carolina. David's calling. Hi, David. You're on with Michael Twitty.
Hello, Tom. How are you doing?
Well.
Well, my family's been in this country for over 180 years. We descended from Africa through slavery. So a lot of our culture remained intact, being on a small island. They did not build a bridge to the mainland until 1950s. So a lot of the African traditions and customs remained intact for many, many years. So, you know, we descended from Angola, Africa. So a lot, the climate there is very similar to the climate here on Hilton Head. Mm-hmm. And so we farmed, we fished, I mean, with, you know, collard greens, corn, the yams and all types of vegetables that, you know, that's how we grew up here on Hilton Head. And, you know, those are the same foods that a lot of the slave cooks made for their owners. You know, so me, I'm a chef. So, I mean, I didn't really embrace my culture and heritage until after I came back from college onto the island. So, right. You know, the food really does bring whites and blacks together, because a lot of, you know, your poor white folks in this area ate the same food as the African Americans ate. So it's really the way I see it now, it's like it's a bond that brings us all together. But when you're growing up in school, you don't hear about these stories about the slaves and what they cooked. You just hear about, you know, the ownership of slaves and mm-hmm. what they meant to the plantation owners, but not the rich culture that they brought to this country.
David, I'm so glad you've called. Michael, I wish you'd respond to that. Here's David. He's gone back to his family history, very aware of it, all the way back to Africa, right in your stream there. He sees the food as something that brings white and black together, bonds them. How do you see it, Michael?
Totally encapsulates everything that I say. Totally encapsulates it all. I mean, there you have, but, you know, also you have Hilton Head, which is becoming, you know, which is becoming, let me not be dishonest, which has become pretty much a resort. It's predominantly no longer in the hands of the folks who cultivated it, who were promised 40 acres and a mule, who had to fight for everything they got and then have slowly over time lost it. That's critical. I mean, that's the other critical element here. You know, I write in the book about Southerners being a family, and I mean it.
Mm-hmm.
But we're a family that has to really come to grips with what that familyhood means. I mean, that's the antidote to divisiveness. The antidote is really understanding how you fit in. I mean, one of the greatest things about what our caller just said was, I know where I come from. Mm-hmm. I come from this island. We're right across the ocean. We eat this food. We cook this food. But you don't hear about it. And he said the same thing I said at the beginning of my book, which mm-hmm. was, I didn't grow up liking this stuff because I didn't understand the meaning of it. You know, it didn't look like what you saw in contemporary American food culture, especially not popular food culture.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we were raised on our good food at home, and then we have this lure of fast food, which wrecked our health, wrecked our diets, wrecked our perspective on eating, you know, mm-hmm. and then we had to come back home. So you see this often with African-American folks, is homecoming back to, you know, better eating, homecoming back to natural soul food, and not healthier soul food, just soul food as it is, as it was, which was not quite the same thing as the comfort food that people associate with Southern food, soul food. You know, those terms mm-hmm. are interchangeable mm-hmm. sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
But you know what I'm saying? But that familyhood is so important to me because I don't want people to lose sight of the fact that almost everywhere I went in the South, white folks would say to me, we're probably related. Those are the first words, and that is a far cry.
And they were not wrong. You're genealogical.
They were not wrong. And there was a far cry from what you might have heard mm-hmm. 20, 30, mm-hmm. 10 years ago.
Mm-hmm. Familyhood, and yet we tend to associate family with comfort. And you called your tour the discomfort tour. I mean, you write here, there's a lot of beautiful and a lot of ugly mashed together. Where does the discomfort come in?
Discomfort is when you realize that the food that you enjoy did not come to the table easily, that there was a lot of suffering on many people's parts to get it to that table, and that it wasn't just Southern. It was across the globe. The South is not the home. The South is not the natural home of prejudice, racism, bigotry. It just happens to be a place where those things have had a lasting scar on the soul of a region. I don't want to impugn the South in that way because I love the South above all else. But the bottom line for me is that you have to understand that kinfolk don't always get along and kinfolk don't always treat each other right. Mm-hmm. And then sometimes kinfolk don't even realize they're kinfolk to each other.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes that gives people license to be not just cruel but destructive. And that's where the table comes back in, the metaphor of the table comes back into play, because this table of brotherhood that Dr. King spoke about
mm-hmm.
is the means by which I hope that what I write and what I say and what I live will actually begin to sort of peel back these layers of ugly that we've inherited, that we will continue to deal with for a long time to come.
genealogy very important to you? You did a lot of DNA testing, traced back to different parts of Africa, different parts of Europe, and not just cheek swabs here. I mean, you actually went back and figured out, you've got a chapter in the book, The Cooking Gene, called White Man in the Woodpile, which goes back mm-hmm. to your white ancestor. I guess it's Richard Henry Bellamy.
One of many, yes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. The one that you profile here.
Yes.
And you actually sort of tromped back to the spot where that family lived.
Yeah. The plantation of my fifth great grandfather would have been his grandfather, his father's father, in eastern North Carolina in Nash County. And I was looking around. I mean, you do everything. African American genealogy is so difficult. You do everything you can to find every little tidbit. Mm-hmm. And like I said before, a lot of these historic landscapes have been paved over. You would never guess that your cul-de-sac is standing on a plantation
yeah,
or something.
Yeah.
But in this case, it wasn't. It was mm-hmm. it was a historically protected building in the woods.
This is east of Durham, North Carolina, as I recall.
Oh, way east. Mm-hmm. Way east. Mm-hmm. And actually, it was one of many Bellamy plantations. They were first in North Carolina, started in the 1670s, mm-hmm. and then they migrated to Alabama. And that plantation, my great-great-great-grandfather would have definitely seen and played on that plantation as a young boy. There were almost 50 enslaved people, most of whom were sold off on Christmas Day mm-hmm. when my fifth great-grandfather had died.
Mm-hmm.
I don't believe I'm from any of the black folks who were there. They may be co-relatives later on in the story because several of them, I think 10 or so, go with his son to Alabama to become part of his chattel in Alabama. But I saw my fifth white great grandfather's big house, everything but the kitchen. The kitchen had actually fallen mm-hmm. into complete ruin. Mm-hmm. And because they used to take the nails and the boards from these old kitchens and use them in other buildings.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's right. But I did see where the kitchen was. I mean, you could see the ruin of it. And I saw his grave and the grave of my fifth great grandmother. He was born during the Revolution. His father was an orphan of the Revolution. So, I mean, being able to say that much, being able to mm-hmm. you know, and it's still surrounded by cotton and tobacco fields, which is even crazier.
And yes.
You know, it was like, it's eerie. It's totally eerie.
It was not a parking lot. It was not a suburban cul-de-sac.
No, it was the serious country. And I just learned the other day ago mm-hmm. that the man who currently owns the land from another family, I may be related to him, the man I talk about in the book.
Yes.
So I have to call him again and say, okay, you know, the partner we may be related to.
You've got Sarah Palin, you claim, somewhere along the way.
That tripped me out. Sarah Palin and Dick Cheney and Samuel L. Jackson, although I'm waiting for Samuel L. Jackson to call me up
okay.
as a cousin and be like, what's in your wallet?
Because, right.
You know, but Sarah Palin, that one got me. I was like, okay, really? Really, Sarah?
Well, you start looking and the tendrils go wide. Brenda in Aiken.
Yes, they do.
Aiken, South Carolina. You're on with Michael Twitty, Brenda. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom and Michael. What one of your earlier callers said just catapulted a memory for me. I grew up in Upper East Tennessee in the heart of the Appalachian Mountains.
Mm-hmm.
And I went away to college and years later was living in Washington, D.C. and dating a black man.
Mm-hmm.
And one day he said, I want to take you out for soul food. I want you to experience soul food. So he took me to this little hole in the wall in his neighborhood, and there was a buffet, and you would point to what you wanted, and they would make a plate for
mm-hmm.
you. And I'm standing there looking at this array of food and dishes, and I put my hands on my hips, and I said, this is soul food? I said, this is just food. Everything there was what I had grown up with. Soup, beans, cornbread, mm-hmm. greens, mm-hmm. Fried potatoes, fried chicken, and it was what my mother had put on the table every day.
As a white girl in East Tennessee.
Exactly.
What do you say, Michael? here we get to who owns what?
Well, you know, here's the deal. Who owns Southern food? Those who are willing to deal with the baggage of its history. Mm-hmm. And those who are willing to take responsibility for its future. The bottom line here is that doesn't surprise me. Because guess what? White indentured servants and enslaved black people lived side by side in the Tidewater South. Mm-hmm. And then those people became the settlers of Appalachia. The ones that kept moving went on to Kentucky, West Tennessee, Missouri, Arkansas, Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, East Texas, Eastern Oklahoma. It's amazing how the diet of the Upper South is all it's the same food from the Eastern Shore of Maryland and Eastern
all of
Virginia,
which you call the Old South in your culinary kind of frame.
Right, all the way to Eastern Oklahoma and East Texas. It's the same food. And then there's the Lower South elements. It made me chuckle, the story, because it's exactly right. I mean, the point I try to make is that it's some of the issues of power that set us apart. Not necessarily the ingredients. Mm. And sometimes it's the style. Mm-hmm. Some, you know, Edna Lewis once famously said, "The difference between soul food and Southern food is ours just tastes better." Which is, you know, those are fighting words, right?
Yes, they are.
But I mean that's a good natured ribbing.
Yeah,
it's less a point about who's better, who's not.
Yeah.
But I still totally sympathize with it. It's funny how white Southerners and black Southerners become, you know, as we say, I'm Jewish, so I say I'm in Hebrew, I'm echad, one people, when we're in a non-Southern place, and all of a sudden we're like looking for the first Southerner we can find. So we could, you know, we could identify and eat good and eat right, you know. Eugene Walter, who wrote infamously wrote the book Southern Style Cooking for Time Life Books, said his best pal in Rome as he was an expat was Leontine Price because they could make butter beans together.
Now wait a minute, you just mentioned you're Jewish. You have a very distinctive profile that you bring to this whole excursion. You're just black, Jewish, gay, culinary historian. You've got your own take. How did you end up Jewish out of this history?
I hit the jackpot, didn't I?
Well, yes. Yeah, you got it all, man. give us a quick tour.
So the quick tour is that, and I want to write more in the future about Judaism, Jewish food, and my identity. That's, I think that's the next big project I want to work on. Mm-hmm. But the bottom line for me is my DNA, my family history has these hints of Jewish connection. That was great. But that really, I converted when I was in my 20s. And I grew up in a neighborhood that had a lot of Jewish folks, and
outside Washington, D.C.
Outside of Washington, D.C. It wasn't a big surprise to me. It was part of parcel of my raising. Mm-hmm. But I talk about it in the book in the context of this was the through becoming part of this community in the course of, you know, 15 years. I've been officially Jewish on paper for like 15 years now. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But also let's add another 15 years of whatever on top of that, growing up, just exploring and learning more. It was like going to another country and figuring out just how American you are. You get me? Mm-hmm. Or any identity that you have. Mm-hmm. You know, you could be British in America and find out just how British you are. Mm-hmm. And so I needed – that's what gave me the impetus to actually explore more of my African-American heritage was by being an American Jew.
Michael W. Twitty brings it all to the table. On that table – in this book, a lot of Southern food from what he calls the Old South. He reinterprets antebellum, pre-Civil War, Southern cooking, and he makes sure that everybody who eats it and thinks about it and reads about it remembers all the history in it. Behind us right here, Soul Food, Goody Mob, with CeeLo Green there. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. On the block, ain't never had a lot, but thankful for the little that I got. Why not be? Fast food got me for the sick. Them
recordable.
It's your soul. Well, good old-fashioned soul food. All right.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about the food of the American South and the story it tells, the slave story especially. Hard story, soulful story. With culinary and cultural historian Michael W. Twitty. His new book out today is The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. And he traveled widely through that South, picking up stories of this cuisine, its history, who cooked it, where the ingredients came from. And we're talking Africa to the Caribbean, back to Africa, to the U.S. He reinterprets the antebellum style of cooking, and the book is The Cooking Gene. You can join us this hour. What do you make of this story, of this framing of the food, Southern food, the Old South? Michael Twitty is with us in Richmond. Michael, lots of response online for you. On Twitter here, Niall says, I was born in Liberia to parents stationed there with Citibank. When I moved to South Carolina, part of me felt like I had returned, kind of making your point. Grant writes on Twitter, a Southern meal is an exercise in thanks to all those that survived before us. Your point. Another listener says, I've heard that much Southern cooking has its roots in the fact that slaves and to a lesser degree poor whites got what was essentially the scraps, the cuts no one else wanted, pork neck bones, ham hock, pig's feet, oxtail, wild game, and so on. And yet it is delicious. I think it's a testament to the resilience and creativity of those people. They were able to take what was essentially the rich white kid's kitchen leavings and turn it into wholesome and tasty food. Do you see it that way, Michael?
Well, I want to caution people about the scraps narrative because that's sort of true, but it's sort of not true.
Okay.
And I'll tell you why. Slavery was colloquial and discretionary, and so is the story of Southern food. In other words, locality, personal choice, legalities, and flexibilities with those conditions and ecosystems has a huge effect on the narrative. So there's no generic narrative.
Wait a minute. Slavery was discretionary? What do you
colloquial
mean?
And discretionary.
Yeah.
Unto the slaveholder.
Okay.
And to the enslaved.
Mm.
Well, how much resistance – every enslaved person resisted slavery – in micro and macro ways.
Mm.
And every slaveholder tried to exert as much control as possible. As I write in this book, the maximum amount of control for the least amount of calories.
Mm-hmm.
And see, that's where the scrap thing comes in. In West Africa, you eat the whole animal, okay?
Mm-hmm.
Anytime you get fresh meat is a blessing. It's a whole animal. In medieval Europe, the lord of the manor got what? The meatier, choicer cuts.
Mm-hmm.
The serfs got what? The bonier parts.
Mm-hmm.
That's a medieval European narrative, not necessarily an African one. But what happens is when our ancestors become acculturated to Western culture, they begin to think in Western ways. And one of which is, oh, I'm getting the worst parts. Whereas you tell a Nigerian that, you know, or a Ghanaian that the head of the whatever, the tail of the animal, the feet mm-hmm. is bad, they're going to laugh at you.
Mm-hmm.
That narrative mm-hmm. has nothing to do with them.
Mm-hmm.
So it's important for us to, you know, again, have the other part of the story so we can actually begin to get into the heads and minds of these human individuals
mm-hmm.
of whom we have very little.
That remains. You bring a lot back in The Cooking Gene. Bringing the nuance here. Aaron in Fort Lauderdale, Florida, you're on with Michael Twitty. Thank you for calling, Aaron. You're on the air.
Hey, Tom. Hey. I appreciate the call. I was driving in my car and listening to the show. I pulled over. I have family I've been able to do our historical mm-hmm. background back to 1853 mm-hmm. out of Tarboro, North Carolina, which All right. is Edgecombe
mm-hmm.
County.
Mm-hmm.
And yes. When my great-grandmother passed along, she pass along family traditions of how foods are prepared. But when I've gone to North Carolina, I've actually sat across the table from the descendants of the people who owned some of my past relatives. And so mm-hmm. we've come to a understanding, and they still continue to farm the land, which has cotton, tobacco, corn, and soybeans on it. But when you look at the acreage and you look at the time, and you wonder, how did people do this? Mm. But it's when you go there and you see the people and you sit across the table and you're eating a cornbread dish, mm-hmm. what we call hoe cakes, mm-hmm. souse, pork chops, kale, collard greens, and the way it's prepared, mm-hmm. It gives you a very wholesome and humbling feeling. But I had to pull over and make that call.
I'm glad that you did, Aaron. Does that food still matter to you, Aaron? Is it still part of your regular diet, or is it for a holiday?
It's on a regular basis. When I go back to Tidewater and I'm driving up I-95, mm-hmm. I can stop in Savannah, Georgia. I can stop in North Carolina, which I do when I go to Norfolk. It's a part of what I look forward to. And I take the rural routes and I stop at some of the local venues to eat. Mm-hmm. It's just it's a beautiful feeling when you're able to sit down and enjoy a meal that goes back years.
Mm. I love it, and I appreciate the call very much, Aaron. Thank you for pulling over to make it. I mean, that's the kind of awareness you're talking about here, Michael. Very direct.
Yeah. And to that, I wanted to just kind of give a little sampling from the book that kind of speaks to his comment.
Mm-hmm.
And I write this. I dare to believe that all Southerners are a family. We are not merely Native European and African. We are Middle Eastern and South Asian and East Asian and Latin American now. We are a dysfunctional family, but we are a family. We are unwitting inheritors of a story with many sins that bears the fruit of the possibility of 10 times redemption. One way is through reconnection with the culinary culture of the enslaved, our common ancestors, and restoring their names on the roots of the Southern tree and the table whose roots support. The Old South is where I cook. The Old South is a place where food tells me where I am. The Old South is a place where food tells me who I am. The Old South is a place where food tells me where we have been. The Old South is where the story of our food might just tell America where it's going. And I paraphrase Langston Hughes, The Old South with soul food in its mouth. And I, who am African-American, must know her.
Michael Twitty and a little Langston Hughes from The Cooking Gene. His new book is just out today. Morgan in Kent, Ohio. Aaron, thank you for calling from Fort Lauderdale. Morgan in Ohio, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. This is actually a really timely broadcast, and I'm enjoying it a lot because I'm reading a book right now, a very in-depth biography about George Washington. And one of the characters that comes up in this book during his presidential terms is actually his slave cook named Hercules, who is a very, very interesting person. And one of your previous callers was talking about table scraps, and that made me think about all of the dinners that George Washington would host as president during his first and second terms, and all of this genteel society would come to these dinners, and the dinner, which was applauded by everybody who ate it pretty much, mm-hmm. was prepared by this cook named Hercules, and this guy was, you wouldn't expect it, I don't think, from a slave at that time, but because of his abilities in the kitchen, he was given, velvet clothing and brass-handled canes and all of these sorts of gifts by his owner, unfortunately.
George Washington.
By George Washington, yeah. And my real question here, aside from bringing Hercules into the conversation, who mm-hmm. I think is just a very interesting person anyway,
mm-hmm.
Is how much of modern-day soul food would have been reflected in the colonial era around the time of the birth of our country? What sorts of things would people like George Washington, James Madison, Thomas Jefferson, these Virginian slave owners, what kinds of things would their cooks have been serving up for them? Because I have a hard time believing that it would be, a modern-day sort of soul food, but maybe it would be. I don't know.
Michael, is it in your wheelhouse?
I love that question. I love that question because I have defined modern-day soul food as the memory cuisine of the great-grandchildren of enslaved people. So we use this term soul food in a very flexible way.
Mm-hmm.
And a flexible way to say, in other words, it's a very mobile term. It means the vernacular ethnic cuisine of black people in America.
Mm-hmm.
But we also say other people have soul foods as well. So, for example, if you were to come to – I invite all of you to come to Colonial Williamsburg when I'm there sometime interpreting in the Peyton Randolph kitchen. Mm-hmm. People want to know where that macaroni and cheese comes from. Well, it comes from macaroni pie. Who introduced that to America? Thomas Jefferson via James Hemings, the best chef in early America. So what we're really talking about is, you know, a very – the stuff that you get in a meat and three.
James Hemings as in Sally Hemings?
As James Hemings as in the brother of Sally mm-hmm. Hemings, and they are both the half-brother and half-siblings to his wife.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it's that's what I mean. It's that complicated.
Mm-hmm.
The bottom line is James Hemings has this, you know, French training, from Paris, from the court at Versailles, and then you know he's you know complimented by people saying that Jefferson's table is half Virginian, half French in style, in good taste and abundance. Well, you know what the Virginia part meant. Afro-Virginian, African
mm-hmm.
Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
So when people see me make this sort of proto, as Dr. Lenny Sorensen once put it, proto-Southern food, proto-soul food, it's not going to be, you know, the same deal. But there are going to be collard greens. We know they were there in 1780, 1781. There are going to be – there's going to be barbecue. There is going to be fried chicken. There is going to be – there'll be biscuits. There will be so many things that people are familiar with today. It may not – taste exactly the same. It may not look exactly the same, but a large part of that larder is there. But what people remember from the, you know, the last generation, generation that comes north and east and west, they have all, it's already changed so much because of industrialized food. That's a big factor.
Mm-hmm.
Second
mm-hmm.
of all, it's not coming right out of the ground. You know, there is a certain thing as terroir, and it is very important to the South mm-hmm. and its culinary legacy.
Mm-hmm.
And the third part is, you know, yes, I love my mother's macaroni and cheese recipe is in the book.
Mm.
But it's nothing like the macaroni pie that James Hemings made.
For
not
Thomas
really.
Jefferson. Okay.
Yeah, for Thomas Jefferson.
Yeah.
You know, and so that we have to really kind of put in perspective. But it's important to see it as a descendant cuisine.
Mm-hmm.
So when I do make people those familiar iconic dishes – in the colonial way, in the 1750 to 1800, like, give or take,
mm-hmm.
way, and talk to them about that early antebellum period as being formative. 1780 to 1820 is really the period where all these Southern classic foods are officially on paper somewhere, and so therefore people are playing with the recipes. And they're there because not only has slavery become more entrenched, but our people are here for the good. And that's just a fact. So, yeah, a hamburger today is not the same as a hamburger that was served in Lower East Side in 1880. But it's still a hamburger.
Stan in New Orleans. Thank you very much, Stan. You're on the air with Michael Twitty.
Hey, hi, Tom. I'm in New Orleans, obviously. It's ripe with culinary cuisine. And,
sure.
But the question is this. I love Willie Mae's Scotch House, but I literally can only do it twice a year. And with my wife, a local nurse, we're seeing a type of diabetes rate that's off the charts. Is this cultural identity with this food, is it a new form of enslavement when it comes to a health crisis in America?
Whoa. There's a real question, Michael.
Nope. Nope. And I'm going to tell you why.
Well, look around. We've got a problem. Stan's not wrong.
Well, guess what?
Yep.
In this book, I talk about health. I had to address it. Otherwise, people would, you know, I don't want people maligning the celebratory. Adrian Miller, you know, who wrote a beautiful book about soul food, says that there's a difference between the basic everyday food of rural Southerners, rural Black Southerners in particular, and the celebratory food people associate with. It's no different from any other ethnic group, right?
Mm.
You know, in the Jewish community, you can't eat kugel every day
mm-hmm.
and brisket
mm-hmm.
and gribenis,
mm-hmm.
the old style Ashkenazi food. You can't eat that every day. So what do you do with that? Same thing African-American folks. You know, I have sauteed, you know, collard greens in this book,
mm-hmm.
which is like plasas from West Africa, which is a much more healthier version. But, hey, the bottom line is still part of the tradition. So one of our scholar friends, Tambra Ray Stevenson, is a nutritionist, and she talks very passionately about, you know, being, you know, enslaved to the hospital. Sort of what the caller was saying, mm-hmm. but it's not. But it's about knowing the wide variety of foods of Africa, the African diaspora, and African America. It's about knowing that our ancestors were vegivores; they weren't carnivores. It's about knowing that so many elements, not having access to land, is killing us.
But the, but the way people eat it today, if you, if we only eat the celebratory version of a cuisine, the thing that was, you know, that day of celebration where, yeah, you packed on the fat and grease and all the rest, and it was once or twice or whatever a year.
Right.
That surely can be a problem.
Yes, but it's not just, but it's not just centered in our cuisine. A lot of it is centered in fast food, which is in our cuisine.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I mean, it's just. I mean, people have to put things in perspective. I don't want to malign. It's another way of pathologizing Black culture, and I'm not down for that.
We're not here to do that today. We have surely enjoyed this tour, though. Is your discomfort tour a permanent thing at this point, Michael Twitty? Are you always out
every
there?
Day of my life?
This is a very, very interesting book, and I want to thank you for it. It's just out today. It's called The Cooking Gene, A Journey Through African-American Culinary History in the Old South. And listeners, you can find an excerpt, really fun to read, and some of Michael Twitty's recipes at our website.
And might I say, beautiful illustrations by Stephen Kratz.
Duly noted. Check it all out at our website, onpointradio.org. We didn't even get to you and Paula Deen. Come back, we'll do it another time. Michael Twitty,
thank you, sir.
Wonderful talking with you. Thanks so much for joining
us. Thank you, Tom. Thank you, thank you.
Good luck with everything. Michael Twitty, The Cooking Gene. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.